Hello. Thank you for joining us today for this episode of New Books in Philosophy. I'm Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figder. Carrie is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. My guest today is William Edmondson. Bill is Regents Professor of Law and Philosophy at Georgia State University in Atlanta. He works at the intersection of political philosophy and law and has helped to shape current discussions of political obligation, equality, punishment, and the duty to obey the law. His latest book is newly out in paperback with Cambridge University Press. It is titled John Rawls, Reticent Socialist. Now, John Rawls is easily the most celebrated and influential political philosopher of the 20th century, and his impact remains remarkably strong today. The central concepts with which his theory of justice begins are now components of the philosophical vernacular: the original position, the veil of ignorance, primary goods, the two principles of justice, especially the difference principle. These will all be well known to the majority of those listening to this podcast. Yet it's less commonly acknowledged that the apparatus that I've just referenced is but the beginning of his theory, and ultimately not its central concern. Throughout his work, Rawls is attempting to address a fundamental philosophical question. Can a society committed to the freedom and equality of its citizens yet arrange social institutions in a way that reliably cultivates within the persons that are its citizens attitudes and dispositions that are required for social justice? In his book, Edmondson argues that Rawlsian justice calls for a socialist economic order. Could it be that America's premier political philosopher was a socialist? There's a lot to talk about. But let's begin with our guest. Hello, Bill.
Hi, Bob.
How are you today?
Very well.
Great. Why don't you start us off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I was born and grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, growing up in the 1950s and 60s. It was an interesting place to grow up. My dad owned a toy store that happened to be located near one of the federal housing projects occupied almost exclusively by blacks. This was a very segregated city, and just hanging out at Dad's toy store, I got a view of society that was, to me, kind of disturbing. I remember vividly some black kids being asked to leave the store. They'd just come in. And I remember a look I was given by one of the kids, puzzling, why does this kid get to stay and why do I have to leave? And as the 60s unfolded, Birmingham was the center of a great deal of tumult. And about the same time, I was getting ready for college and having to face the question of whether or not to take advantage of the student deferment available to those who were fortunate enough to be able to go to college. These things stayed with me, and I think fed a continuing interest in matters of justice and the right ordering of society. It wasn't, I really can't say I was focused on philosophy until I returned to college after an interruption occasioned by the draft, and was trying to put together my view of the world at a time when things really seemed to be quite unsettled, and worked on philosophy of language, philosophical logic, things like that, but found myself drawn back into political philosophy. One turning point, I guess, was reading Concept of Law by H.L.A. Hart, and got me to thinking about what law was. What was it about the law that demanded the respect that we much of the time, many of us think it deserves.
Excellent. So the book is about John Rawls, somebody also influenced by H.L.A. Hart, no doubt. Yes. And, you know, I suspect a lot of our listeners will know, you know, there's a lot that's been written about Rawls at this point. It's a mountainous secondary literature, and it continues to grow. I should note, though, that your book is among the first that I'm aware of, at least, to attempt what we might think of as a synoptic interpretation of the work on a standard sort of understanding of Rawls's work. There's the first book that's about justice. There's a second book. It's about legitimacy or justification, which is different from justice. And then there's a third book, which, is, not fully baked, which is about human rights, of some kind, and about global justice, but, not really. Even some of Rawls' students are very critical of that third book for having, lost the plot, as it were. But your book is different. So your book aspires to see the Rawlsian work as a philosophical unity. And I should say yours is the first book that I know of that takes, his later work, which is, almost a posthumous work, which is called Justice is Fairness, a Restatement. You take the restatement as a culminating work rather than, what I take it to be is a, sort of a more common view of that work, that the restatement is a kind of loose summary or, as a colleague once put it, theory of justice for the undergrads. Can you tell us a little bit about sort of your approach to Rawls as a figure and the aspiration to see the political philosophy as a whole?
I first became aware of Rawls in college. I was informed by one of my teachers that there was this big book by a man named John Rawls. And my familiarity with him was mostly, I guess, secondary through his view of civil disobedience. And I took a look at the book and read it. I think I got to part three, but I was under impressed. It appeared to me that Rawls's approach was a very conservative one that was simply not to my liking, really. Was asked to cover for a colleague who had to be absent to conduct a reading group on political liberalism when it came out in 1993. And that book did not impress me either. And it was at this time that in conversations with colleagues, I pressed the point that Rawls's difference principle was essentially the same idea that was floated by the Reagan and Thatcher programs for raising all boats, allowing the good things of an unequal society to trickle down to the less advantaged. And so for a long time, my view of Rawls was not altogether positive. It was only when I tried to teach a course on theories of justice that I looked at the restatement as a possible, possibly an accessible, easy to read and follow account of a theory of justice that students, graduate students and law students could take as a sort of a springboard for a wider discussion. It was only after reading the book that I realized this is not simply a dumbing down or a Cliff's Notes version of Rawls's view. This represents some very major refinements and adjustments in his view. And it also is evidently an attempt to combine three decades of work into a synoptic and coherent scheme. And two of the three adjustments in the book were pretty clearly flagged right up front. One being that Rawls was going to combine the political liberalism and public reason thinking, reintegrate that with justice, fairness, which is how I refer to his substantive theory of justice. Secondly, was a reconfiguration of the argument for the two principles of justice as fairness, something that he said he had to do in response to criticisms from Kenneth Arrow and others, John Harsanyi. So this was new, and also new, but not as clearly flagged in the introduction to Justice as Fairness Restatement, was a consideration of the possibility of institutionalizing or realizing justice as fairness in institutions. And he distinguished clearly for the first time five distinct regime types: laissez-faire capitalism, welfare state capitalism, one-party state socialism, property-owning democracy, and liberal democratic socialism. Those are the five. And he dismissed laissez-faire capitalism and one-party state socialism rather curtly on the ground that they don't embody a principle of reciprocity, in short, and don't take seriously the fair value of political liberty. What was a surprise was his dismissal of welfare state capitalism. Rawls had just been generally understood to be an apologist for welfare state capitalism, and it ought to have, I think, been more widely noted that he expressly rejects the possibility of realizing justice as fairness in a welfare state capitalist regime. That left two men standing, as it were, property-owning democracy and liberal democratic socialism. And there he stopped. And he said, I won't go, can't go any further. You can't settle this alternative on one of these two alternatives as a matter of first principle. You need to have more information about the political culture, the level of economic level of economic development, the geography, the resources, and so forth of a particular peoples in order to make this choice. Of course, what he's talking about here is the constitutional stage of the four-stage sequence that is outlined in Theory of Justice to complete checking of the eligibility of principles of justice.
Right. So let me break in here and just ask. So So you're right that, you know, it's very easy to find in the pretty extensive literature surrounding Theory of Justice, surrounding the book, even from the very beginning, critiques from the left and critiques from the right. You know, the people on the left of Rawls or who see themselves on Rawls's left interpret the difference principle as a Reaganite or Thatcherite trickle-down view. The people on the right or see themselves on Rawls's right, interpret the difference principle, as Nozick does, often, that is requiring constant, state intervention and redistribution for, you know, every exchange that occurs between some particular person and Wilt Chamberlain. Can you tell us a little bit about why I take it that you see it as methodological reasons that Rawls wasn't more explicit in his own writing about some of the more institutional issues? Now, you just hinted that, you know, the institutional questions have to come up once we lift the veil a little bit and enter this this other phase of the four-stage process. I take it, though, that Rawls was committed to thinking that the questions that the theory of justice is trying to answer are more abstract and have to be settled before we can start talking about particular economic arrangements. Is that right?
Well, it's sometimes tricky to grasp precisely what Rawls wanted to achieve by distinguishing what he calls ideal theory and non-ideal theory.
Good.
I think this leads to some of the confusion, the idea that the choice of regime type is a matter simply for a separate part of the theory that he wasn't going to attend to. I don't think that's correct. The choice among the five ideal types of regime, as posed in the restatement, is squarely in ideal theory. There will be questions that have to be addressed in non-ideal theory. But as a matter of ideal theory, three of the five can be excluded. And already, this is big philosophical news. Mm. Capitalism cannot realize justice as fairness, period, full stop. That is, I don't think a matter that's left ambiguous after justice as fairness is a restatement. It wasn't clear to a reader of a theory of justice, even as revised. This is a big step. So the resources of ideal theory are equal to the task of excluding as incapable of realizing justice as fairness three of the five regime types, which leads to the question, of course, why not finish the job? And pit what he calls property-owning democracy against liberal democratic socialism and let us know what justice as fairness demands of us as in terms of a choice at the constitutional stage between the five types that he's chosen to identify.
Right. So fill in just a little bit with so when we get to this constitutional stage, still within ideal theory, we are able to start thinking a little bit more institutionally about how to manifest in the social world our principles of justice, which are chosen in the first stage. I take it that at that second stage is when we start learning not only facts about resources and history and culture and the geography of the territory and the rest, but also is that the stage at which we start learning particular facts about human psychology?
The architectonic is not it's a bit like an Escher drawing in a sense. let me put it this way. We begin with the original position and its thick veil of ignorance. And the four-stage sequence running from original position to constitutional convention to the legislative stage to the fourth, what I call administrative cum judicial phase, involves progressive relaxings of the veil or liftings of the veil. There's another division of that's present in theory of justice and is continued in the restatement. He never abandons this. He refers to these as part one and part two of the original position procedure. In part one, the choosers they're choosing as rational and reasonable beings that are not affected by certain, what Rawls calls special psychologies, tendencies to envy, to spite, unusual attitudes toward risk. Not only are the choosers not affected by these special psychologies, they don't yet factor in the circumstance that the citizens for whom they are choosing are affected by these special psychologies. In part two of the original position procedure, the choosers become aware that citizens will be affected by these special psychologies and that they will take an interest in the interests of others. And they may indeed become excusably envious of the inequalities that are tolerated by the principles of justice, whatever they might be. So the underlying concern here throughout is to, well, there are two of them. One of them is to make it clear that the initial derivation of the principles of justice and its egalitarian, the initial egalitarian structure of the original position is not a concession to human propensity to envy or to spite. So the egalitarianism, such as it is, that you get in part one of the original position procedure can't be dismissed as simply an accommodation to the vice of envy. It's also intended to assure that the problem of distributive justice can be solved in a way that renders it a matter of pure procedural justice, how things fall out in the operation of society as a continuing cooperative enterprise, so that we don't have to pay attention to who has what. We can be assured that principles of justice structure the background institutions under which we live in a way that make that distribution fair, whatever it may be. The worry that informs all of Rawls's writing is a worry about stability. We were chatting beforehand, and you observed that part three of Theory of Justice, which is concerned with the development of a sense of justice, is really the most important part of Rawls's 1971 theory. And I agree with that, even though that's the part he took back.
Right.
And political liberalism, which makes it, I think, rather challenging to understand what the man's view is. But I think by looking carefully at the restatement and all of his works, many of which are now in print and available to all, one can put together an understanding of what the deepest motive in Rawls is. And the deepest motive, as I agree with you, is to account for a sense of justice that's capable of stabilizing a well-ordered society in which there will be inequalities of wealth and income, in which there will be also a very wide divergence of diversity of comprehensive conceptions of the good. The second part of the original position procedure asked whether the strains of committing oneself to the principles chosen in the first part are going to be ones that can survive. And that's the flip side of that is, can a sense of justice arise and support itself from generation to generation in a way that will maintain general confidence in citizens that they are, as it were, working off of the same page when making claims against each other in the public political arena.
Great. So that's helpful. Let me ask now about sort of the central argument of the book, the reticent socialist part. So you're arguing that Rawls neglected to explicitly, at least, draw a fairly straightforward conclusion that pretty clearly follows from what he does say about justice, clearly does follow from justice's fairness as a conception of justice. More specifically, you argue that justice's fairness commits one to holding that only a certain kind of socialism, the liberal democratic kind, is capable of satisfying the demands of justice and achieving a stably just society. Now, that argument turns on the role that Rawls gives fairly explicitly to what he calls the fair value of the political liberties. And in fact, that idea of the fair value of the political liberties plays a pretty explicit role in his arguments against laissez-faire and welfare state capitalism in the restatement. So can you tell us a little bit both about the concern for fair value, what that means, and also how that figures into, as you understand it and reconstruct it, the full argument that would get us the liberal democratic socialist conclusion from Rawls?
Okay. Let me begin by just saying what the difference is between Rawls's conception of property-owning democracy and Rawls's conception of liberal democratic socialism.
Good.
He's not as clear as one would like about this, but it comes down to this. Rawls believes that there are certain aspects of the basic structure which can be identified as the means of production. And what I call the property question, he calls, I think, at one point the historic question, is whether the means of production are to be open to private ownership, or whether instead the means of production are to be socially owned in common. By means of production, Rawls is referring to what is sometimes referred to as the commanding heights of the economy. It doesn't reach every particular tool or implement that one might put to productive use. So with this qualification, which I won't repeat, the property question is posed quite squarely in Justice's Fairness or Restatement. Now, fair value comes into this importantly. Fair value is assured only of the political liberties in Justice's Fairness. It may be that your freedom of occupation is worth more than mine is because you're more skilled or more industrious. Justice's Fairness does not guarantee the fair value of the liberties generally, even the first principle liberties, but it does guarantee fair value of the political liberties, not just formal, but fair value, which means rough equality of political influence among those similarly motivated and similarly endowed with persuasive powers, if you like. This is where the real egalitarian bite of justice is fairness is found, as Norman Daniels was the first to point out. But as many people didn't seem to appreciate, the difference principle has been central in discussions of Rawls in a way that obscures the prior role, the lexically prior role, of the first principle guarantee of fair value of political liberties. What does this demand? And Rawls makes one of the more puzzling observations in his entire work in The Theory of Justice, where he says that constitutional democracies don't really seem to have taken this seriously, which is a puzzler, because he's trying to work up a theory of justice for out of the public political culture of constitutional democracies. How can you derive a principled requirement from this set of resources when you're claiming that a certain guarantee of a strong egalitarian guarantee has never been taken seriously? Rawls is entitled to do this if he can show us that, taking everything together, that his theory is one that is persuasive and one that we can live in, that it accounts for our considered judgments in wide reflective equilibrium. Now, what Rawls says about the specific requirements imposed by the first principle guarantee of fair value of political liberty is disappointingly scant. What he does tell us in Justice is Fairness, the restatement, is that he believes that a liberal democratic socialism and a property owning democracy can sufficiently guarantee the fair value of political liberties to cultivate a sense of justice and to stabilize a well-ordered society. How is this done? One wants to know. And in the restatement and other writings, he refers to a number of measures which you can divide into two categories. One is what insulation measures, which are measures which are that are intended to insulate politics from unequal economic power. The worry here is that there's an inherent tendency of economic advantage to translate itself into political advantage. Justice's fairness allows economic inequality, but it does not allow that economic inequality to degrade or to destroy the fair value of political liberties. Well, what's to stop it? Well, the insulation strategies involve certain measures, public financing of campaigns, limitations on private financing, private contributions and spending on campaigns, public subsidies for debates and so on, things of that kind. A second type of reinforcement involves taxes on receipts of inheritance. That way, economic inequalities or economic advantages, I should say, don't easily transmit themselves from generation to generation.
So we already see then the way the argument we can sort of anticipate the way the argument against laissez-faire and welfare state capitalism is now supposed to run. You can see that especially the laissez-faire version of capitalism is not even going to be interested in any insulation strategy.
Right.
And the welfare state capitalist might lament the role of money in politics, for example, but is might lament it, but is not going to see any political measures that would be justified in order to curb it, right?
Right.
Good.
Right. And for not even trying, Rawls dismisses welfare state capitalism.
Right.
No invisible hand is going to make it so that everyone has roughly political influence or has more political influence in virtue of inequality. There's a stark disanalogy between the price system in the economy and the way money works in politics.
Right.
Now the question is then how do we then address the property question from this perspective? If we're concerned about the corrosive effect of the economic inequalities that we will allow, we must allow, according to Rawls, the markets are essential, and they must be housed in a fair basic structure, and that's the challenge for a theory of justice, for a constitutional democracy. If we're faced with a choice between permitting private ownership of the means of production and not permitting it, what reasons would we have from the perspective of the choosers at the Constitutional Convention stage for allowing private ownership of the means of production? Now, this is a question that Rawls poses but never answers, even though if you conceive of society as a fair system of cooperation for mutual benefit, it's very hard to see how you could warrant the private ownership of the means of production in the sense of the commanding heights of the economy. To pose the question is almost to answer it. Although laying it out in detail in the context of Rawls's further refinement of the original position procedure in their statement would take me a little bit longer than we have up to go through.
Right. So, can you tell us a little bit, maybe help draw more starkly the contrast between the liberal democratic socialist economic order and the property owning democracy?
Well, to do that, one thing that has to be understood is that Rawls understood socialism as not a monolithic conception, but as involving, in addition to the emphasis on common ownership of the means of production, there's also a strand of socialist thought that emphasizes workplace democracy or industrial democracy. And I think that Rawls respected those who believed that socialism involves doing something to bring democracy into the workplace, every workplace. I think that his considered view was that the property question, that is, who shall own the means of production, is really the central issue as to whether one is opting for a socialist regime or not. There are a number of nice things we would like socialism to achieve, those of us who don't think of it as a bugaboo. Property owning democracy, in contrast, it's a very hard contrast to draw because, unlike the other four ideal types of regime Rawls sets out in the restatement, property owning democracy has no exemplar. And moreover, the term itself has been variously used by people that are whose tendencies are very, very far from Rawls's, insofar as viewing the recent history of constitutional democracies. It was a term initially coined in the early 20th century by a Tory politician, Noel Skelton, and it was later picked up by Margaret Thatcher. Rawls's source is James Mead, an Oxford and Cambridge economist, who was a member of Clement Attlee's socialist government in the 1945 to 1951 period. And as I read Mead was not discussing what he called the property-owning democracy as an alternative to socialism at all, but as a way forward for socialists that a socialist government that had already nationalized the means of production in Britain. And part of the book, I go over Rawls's likely exposure to the British socialist regime, or just recently voted out British socialist regime during his stay at Oxford in 52-53. I don't think Rawls was ever clear about property-owning democracy. Now, there are a number of people now that are trying to work out a conception of property-owning democracy. I don't discuss them in detail in the book, but they're certainly worth looking at in detail. Alan Thomas, for example, has published a book, Republic of Equals, which works out a view opposite to mine. He says that Rawls has to reject socialism and embrace property-owning democracy. He's wrong about that, but it's a task. Fortunately for me, it's easier to reconstruct what Rawls meant by socialism because socialism has a history. Property-owning democracy is an idea. and not even a well-formulated idea.
So is the thought that property-owning democracy would permit the social ownership of the means of production at the commanding heights of the economy, but doesn't require it, as socialism, the liberal democratic form, would?
Correct.
Ah, got it. So the argument then is that if what's doing the work in the Rawlsian argument is the fair value of the political liberties, and if we've got good reasons, as you think we do, for claiming that the fair value of the political liberties can be stably secured only when the means of production at the commanding heights of the economic system are collectively owned, then we get the argument that property-owning democracy is not up to the task of securing in a stable way social justice, and only liberal democratic socialism is.
Now, that slightly overstates what's needed here. In the Constitutional Convention, if we're pairwise comparing property-owning democracy and socialism, we make a judgment. We don't have to say that one of them can't possibly do the job. What we ask is one of them better at this? One of them, from all that we can see, better? Would we take a chance with the less likely candidate? If we are satisfied that there's a guaranteeable level that's fully satisfactory under both. And I think the answer from all that Rawls has said in his vast body of work is that we wouldn't take that chance. And Rawls, at several points, it refers to the destabilizing tendencies that might exist in a property-owning democracy, where public and private ownership, the question as between them, is always in play, as it were. Those who are winners that is, or economically better off, might be expected to look at the means of production as something they'd like to own too. Any of us who have played Monopoly as kids, the board game, know how nice that waterworks looks. What a nice pair would go with our electric company. But what does it say? What message do we send to each other as citizens when we flog off the public utility, when we privatize, for example, the penitentiaries, the post office, and so forth? I think Rawls would have been impressed by the communicative disvalue of privatization. What would be gained then by allowing that as an option? It might have some incentive effects. I mean, some people might conceivably work harder if they thought, well, gee, I can buy the electric company. I've got all the hotels I want. We have that too. The task Rawls set himself very early on, I think shortly after his experience in the Second World War, was to tame the claims of utility to make room for justice. And this is an instance in which I think Rawls very definitely was conscious to some degree that he'd set the table for a powerful argument for socialism that he wasn't sure maybe we were ready for.
So is that good? So that's a nice segue to the big question, I think, that your book leads the reader to and then tries to discusses in the final two chapters. So if the argument from justice's fairness, including the fair value of the political liberties commitment, is pretty straightforward, to at least the pairwise comparison between property-owning democracy and liberal democratic socialism, and if, as I think you make a splendid case, a very persuasive case in the book, for thinking that the considerations that drove Rawls's work and his condemnation of the capitalist systems should settle the question between property-owning democracy and liberal democratic socialism in favor of the liberal democratic socialist order. If all of that works out, and you've made a good case that it does, why was he reticent? Why not just explicitly say that why didn't he just say he was a socialist?
Well, that's something I've really struggled with is, one way of understanding that reticence is to consider the personal characteristics of the man himself as reported by, any number of contemporaries. One of Rawls's more memoir-like writings, he discusses his friendship, or as it were, apprenticeship at the knee of Burton Draben, colleague, was actually, I think, younger than Rawls. Draben had a tremendous influence on Rawls, especially when Rawls was taking his political turn. Although the political turn in political liberalism, the Dewey lectures and so forth, seems to have been entirely self-motivated, which reinforces your view that part three of Theory of Justice is really the most important part. He's thinking mostly about that, which would explain why he made that turn while the discussion was about other things, the original position, veil of ignorance, difference principle, and so forth. Draven used to pick at Rawls, by Rawls's account, about not being direct, not being straightforward, being muffled in his writing as an expression. So there's that aspect of it. There's the aspect of Rawls's, I think, and any philosopher's aversion to labels and party identification. Rawls's colleague Hilary Putnam ignored that during the 60s and very early 70s, and allied himself with the Maoist Progressive Labor Party, which was something of a scandal in philosophical circles. I mean, there was something about it that I remember Paul Grice at Berkeley commenting on poor Hilary Putnam, as though he completely lost his mind. And Putnam was shortly to disavow progressive labor. And, well, the spectacle of having to climb down out of an ideological tree in that way so visibly, I'm sure impressed itself on Rawls's mind. One thing that I don't think is widely appreciated is the degree to which Rawls was a Southerner. He's from Baltimore, Maryland, and that's below the Mason-Dixon line. The Mason-Dixon line runs between Maryland and Pennsylvania. And he a number of references in his writings to his sort of, well, at least one that stands out, thinking of himself as a Princeton man. Well, Princeton was long, and is perhaps even now, thought of as the northernmost outpost of the Southern gentleman. I suppose that's right. And Rawls identified himself as a Princeton man who could sort of chuckle at the Yankee pretensions of Harvard, although he was very much indebted to Harvard as an environment for his philosophical developments, along as well as Oxford and Cornell and MIT and so forth. That's where he wound up and spent 30 years or so of his academic life. So his being a colleague of others may have had an influence as well. I don't think he was cowed in any way. I don't think he was afraid of being ostracized or dismissed. But he certainly notes it in his discussions of Mill, for example,
right,
and of Hobbes, that sometimes you cut yourself off from colleagues you would not like to be cut off from because you take a certain stand or are suspected of taking a certain stand. So the question is, what is to be gained by embracing a label? And Rawls was quite clearly dismayed that he had found himself classified as a welfare state capitalist, right, an apologist for the status quo. And he made it, I think, quite plain in the restatement as well in some of his letters that was definitely not his view, and that the most important feature of the sense of justice is a commitment to a principle of reciprocity. We're in this together. I don't benefit at your expense. And that is simply not something that a welfare state capitalist or any capitalist society can cultivate in an individual, except by ideological deception.
Right. Except, you know, there is a, as you're spelling out some of the lesson that he might have learned more or less indirectly from the example of Hillary Putnam. There is a story to be told, I suppose, about the configuration of the Harvard department at that time, because Quine, I'm told, was a real conservative politically. Yes, right. And so I wonder if there wasn't sort of even more to that thought about Mill and Hobbes that you just cited, that in order to get along in a way.
That's a good question, Bob. Rawls took over as chair of the department upon his return from the Stanford Humanities Institute, where he finished Theory of Justice. And I think that he may have and he was getting to be very close to Burton Draben,
right.
Who had some administrative responsibilities as well. And I think that may be another part of it, is that as department chair, he wasn't just, you know, a philosopher who was able to just ignore perceptions of that he might create about the department itself. And certainly, you're right about Quine. I don't think Nozick would have minded at all, but Nozick was never, as far as I know, chair of the department. Nozick's background is rather different than Rawls's in a number of ways. So personality figures into this. There was one interesting point along the way that you can see in political liberalism. I think that it's in the preface to the paperback edition, in which he acknowledges Rodney Peffer's book, in which Rodney Peffer proposes an alternative set of principles of justice, one of which, sort of in an intermediate position in Peffer's list, would have guaranteed a right to workplace democracy. Nothing about the means of production, but about workplace democracy. Mm. And Rawls says, I just don't think that belongs there.
Right.
He doesn't say that doesn't belong anywhere. He says it doesn't belong there. It's not. It can't be a one of the principles of justice. It might be a requirement of the principles of justice, as I read what Rawls is saying. Mm-hmm. And again, it's not what Peffer proposed wasn't socialism in the core focal sense of social ownership of the means of production. As far as workplace democracy goes, I think Rawls was skeptical about that as a general prescription for democratizing society. The fair value of political liberties, which is so important to Rawls, was never translated into a requirement of democracy, even formal political equality within the institutions of civil society, business institutions, churches, universities, and so forth.
Right. So, Bill, we're at the end of our time. It's been really great talking to you about your fabulous book. Last question. Now that we know that America's most influential political philosopher of the last century was in fact a socialist, what's next for you? What's the next project?
Well, several. One is to sort of make sure there aren't any loose ends left. The book, I've learned some more about Rawls since the book was finished that reinforce my account of him. I did some research at the Widener Library at Harvard and looked at some of his lecture notes and have discovered some lectures on democracy in which he engages James Madison. And that's, I think, philosophical news because here you have America's preeminent political philosopher engaging one-sidedly, of course, because Madison's long dead, America's founding political theorist. And his criticisms of Madison are interesting to read. I'm also trying to work out some of the implications of Rawls's view for those of us who live in non-ideal circumstances. What kinds of individual duties do we have here and now? What ought we to do? Is the question. By what ought we to do? I mean, in the distributed sense of what ought I to do now, given that the basic structure of my society is unjust. And that is a difficult question that may take a while to work out.
Yeah. Well, I'm really intrigued by the Rawls lectures on Madison. But the project, the more non-ideal theory, project that you described sounds very exciting, and I'll keep an eye out for that. But for now, Bill, I just want to thank you for your time today, and thank you for appearing on New Books in Philosophy.
Well, I mean, thank you, Bob, and thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about it.
Sure, and thank you, listeners, for joining us today for our discussion of William Edmondson's book. It's titled John Rawls, Reticent Socialist, and it's published now in paperback by Cambridge University Press. Bye for now.